No?
Yep.
Hey, there we go. All right, green light's on. We're on time here. You all ready to go with the equipment? We recording? Okay. So, as you can see from the slide that's been up there forever, I'm Greg Smith, work for Second Quadrant US, consulting company doing Postgres work in the US. This is talk about how you can get information out of the internals of the Postgres database using a handy little facility called user-defined functions. And I'm aiming this really at the basics of this that are actually simple enough that a lot of times they don't even get covered or documented at all. And I think that causes people a lot more trouble than it should. And that's part of the reason I wanted to go over some of them. So the first thing that you should recognize about working on PostgreSQL is a lot of people think, well, I'm going to go get a patch in Postgres, so I'm going to go write a big patch that does a lot of things, and then that'll get it committed because it's really useful. That doesn't actually work. The bigger your patch is, the more likely it is it'll get rejected. Basically, if you want to get a patch into Postgres, write a one-line patch. I've done it on multiple occasions. Those patches pretty much usually go in. And I'm dead serious about that. One lines, 10 lines, something like that. If you submit some patches on that sort of scale, people tend to take bigger patches from you more seriously. If your first patch into Postgres is over 100 lines, forget it. It's not going anywhere. You've basically wasted your time doing that. It's going to be a long time before anyone's going to actually do anything with that patch unless you got things exactly right, which almost never happens. So what are user-defined functions, or UDFs? They're basically just simple functions that you write in C, and it just so happens that they're good for accessing internal stuff. What's interesting about them is there's a lot of stuff that's inside the database that is actually built in terms of UDFs. So once you get to a certain level of code in the database, you discover that there are simple functions that are in there, and the actual Postgres code itself is calling the externally visible functions to do things rather than using regular subroutines, which is kind of a weird thing to see. The documentation actually flat out says this. It says that the quoted bit right there, that the standard internal function library is a rich source of coding examples for user-defined functions. So one of the most useful things that you can do is go through the standard library to go looking for useful code examples to then steal shamelessly and pass off as your own. So there's a couple of tutorials that cover this stuff already. I'm glad Joe Conway's here just in time for me to poke fun at his. Joe wrote a great talk that's about 100 pages long, and basically everyone who's new to Postgres I've shown it to is completely lost by page 21 of that whole thing. It goes really fast, and it's hard to make sense of the stuff if you're new to the code base. Then there's the talk that Neil Conway and Gavin Sherry did. I think both those guys are just too smart to be allowed to write an introductory talk at this point. They thought an appropriate topic for an introductory talk was how to add a whole new bit of SQL and change around how execution gets done for creation of triggers and all this other stuff. It's like, really, that's an introduction to hacking on the whole thing? I thought that would be, you know, a year down the line or something. So I think I get to slide 33 on the whole thing, but I just have no idea what's going on, and then there's another 80 after that. So those are the kind of things that are floating around there that I would recommend you stay away from at the beginning. This is what will happen if you don't. There's a lot of the stuff, and it's really easy to get overwhelmed by all the stuff that's in Postgres. So what are some good tutorials that I would recommend? There's two things in the documentation that talk about UDFs, external functions, and how to build external types. There's actually a two-part article in the Linux Gazette that goes over this whole thing that's an excellent intro. What these articles cover are things like how to set the environment up, how to start compiling your code, how to like write a basic function. I'm not actually going to cover any of that stuff because these tutorials are good for that. Problem is they all kind of end at the same spot, which is leaving you wondering details about the rest of the source code. And the reason that I know where people get stuck at, I worked for 2 years at Treviso, and we went through an expansion period where we're actually hiring recent college graduates and other people that just had never seen the Postgres code base before, and we were just giving them projects and diving in and asking, okay, I interviewed a couple of them, and I pretty much heard the same questions from all of them as far as the bits that are in the Postgres code base that they just go, wait, this isn't explained anywhere, is it? And it's kind of confusing. So I wanted to cover some of those basics for you so you don't fall into those same traps. So the first one, what's a tuple? You'll find that word used all over the place in the source code. You'll even find it in some of the user-defined functions that show statistics and that sort of thing. You'll see tuple counts and stuff like that. Wikipedia says a tuple represents the notion of an ordered list of elements, which is, of course, completely useless. For your perspective, you can think of a tuple as the internal representation of a row. There's some slight semantic differences between what's a tuple and what's a row, but from the perspective of a beginner, when you see tuple, think row, and you'll be good enough to get started. And by the time you actually care about the minor differences between the two, you can go have fun reading up on those whole things. So that's the first bit of terminology. The second one is a little more, and that's standard SQL terminology. You'll see pretty much anything talking about database theory, use that word. A word that is much more specific to Postgres that I get a lot of questions about. Everyone asks, what in the hell is a datum? Now, it's interesting. Again, we get a wonderfully useful definition from datum. It's the singular form of data, duh. I went looking around for a little bit. There's datums all over the place in the Postgres source code, and as far as I can tell, there's absolutely no documentation at any point about what a datum is. It's kind of interesting. But it's open source. We have the source to it. That's how you're kind of expected to figure this whole thing out. So if you go and look at source include postgres.h, that actually is, come to find, the best way to figure out what a datum is. The way it actually works is that a datum is kind of a polymorphic type that can hold anything that fits into the amount of space that's available for it. So if you've got a Boolean or a character, the datum can just hold that Boolean or character. If you've got an integer and it's only a couple of bytes, at least four, you can put that into a datum and then the datum will hold that thing. To use programming language notation, those uses of datums are pass by value. The actual datum itself holds the thing. So if you're passing an integer, the datum will be the integer itself, not any more complicated structure than that. For more complicated structures, use the other way that variables and subroutines get called in programming languages, which is pass by reference. You allocate some memory to hold the larger thing using one of the Postgres allocation routines like PALLOC, and then the datum becomes a pointer to that chunk of data that you've got. If something's over 8 bytes, you definitely can't just fit it in the datum itself. And because of some changes in the code and other stuff, it really depends on what architecture you're on and even what version of Postgres you're on, exactly what goes into a datum directly and what gets put into another structure such that the datum is considered a pointer to it instead. Like there was some refactoring in one of the Postgres 8 versions that changed around date or timestamp handling for one of these things. So the trick is, if you've got something that definitely could be large enough to not trivially fit in a datum, what ends up happening is there's a bunch of macros that are defined, that are available for you, that they kind of abstract away these little differences. So, you know, like there's this thing called datum get in 64 that will take in something that is a 64-bit integer that's in a datum, and, you know, you'll actually get that back in a useful form that you can work on it. Without you actually having to know whether that datum is just an 8-byte thing that can actually hold the whole integer 64, or whether that datum is just a pointer to where that 8 bytes is stored somewhere else. There's also similar macros like that that, you know, hide the implementation details for the bigger float types and the date and time types and all this other stuff. So pretty much any time you're working with datums, if they're not trivial, you're constantly using these macro functions in order to convert stuff back and forth to datums. So what about strings? Strings are stored at the basic level in the database as standard C strings, which are a series of bytes, and then it ends with a null character. There's a data type for that called the C string. And you have to dig into the source code to realize that when you see C string, that's just a character pointer abstracted away through a couple of different levels of macro definitions on the whole thing. So C strings are the most fundamental of the string types in the database, but there's actually a couple of more that are built on top of it that it's good to be aware of. Like there's also another thing called a string info. if you've got a C string, you don't really know how long it is. You don't know how much space was allocated for it. It doesn't have any of this metadata that describes what's in this string. So string info adds that stuff in. It adds in what the current length of the string is. It adds in what the maximum space available for the string is. And it's not even necessarily, you know, a proper string that is text even. It could just be some binary data that happens to be close enough to a string and null terminated that it just gets thrown into one of them. So, you know, this is another higher level thing that can end up being more useful if you've actually got to allocate, if you're allocating memory for a string and you want to be able to deallocate it cleanly later and be able to find out how big it is and stuff like that, you might go up one layer up the abstraction chain and use a string info for that instead. And some of the functions you'll find in the database do that. So you've got a datum, you see a function takes a datum in, how do you know what you have? Well, there isn't any way to tell. If you've got a datum that's an integer, it's going to be an integer that has the value. How do you tell that from a datum that is a pointer to something? You can't. So the way this works is that anywhere the database uses datums for things, somewhere else is an explicit type that describes what that is supposed to be, that's carried along outside of that datum, kind of from the context that it appears in. So when you build a user-defined function, getting back to where I was going with all this, when you list the input and output parameters, those are all going to get passed to your code as datums, and you have to go in and label that kind of conversion table for, okay, the first datum that I'm passing in is of this type, the second datum I'm passing in is of this type. You have to label all that stuff, and then there are more macros that kind of sort all that out for the database so it can work on them. So we'll see some examples of that. Here's how that might work for a function we'll look at for a couple of slides here. This is current_setting is a function in the database that returns back some setting in the database from your postgresql.conf and shows you what it is. So this is the actual source code that maps that so that it can get called by the database. And this is all inside a chunk of source code called pg_proc.h that all the functions in the database are being. So the interesting parts of this, each function in the database and each of the data types in the database gets assigned what's called an object ID or OID. That's how the database keeps these things all straight. They all get a unique ID, and those numbers kind of go up. So in this case, the OID for this particular function is 2077, and I'll go over in a minute how you actually get allocated an OID for something that you want to do. So this is saying that we have a function that its external name is current setting. And it's running through the standard Postgres namespace and user identification stuff. And all of these other things, it's not super important that you even understand how they all work at the beginning because, again, the MO on this thing is to find something that's as similar as possible to the function that you want to build and just steal that line from that existing function and then change things until you actually get it to work. The two bits that are actually important here to get are in the middle of that whole thing. There's a section that reads 102525. That's the thing that you're the most likely to end up messing with. The first of those numbers is how many input parameters the thing takes. In this case, it takes in a single one. The second one is how many output. Or what type its output parameter is in. So when you see 25 here, 25 is the OID inside the database of something that's a piece of text. So what this cryptic line is saying is that this thing takes an input parameter of type text and then returns an output parameter that is also of type text. So that's what those two 25s are. If there were more parameters, the second 25 that's in quotes would actually have some more information there. And then the other bit here, you notice that the name of the function inside the first thing here where it says current setting at the beginning of the line, that's the name of the thing that you call in the database. So if you call this thing, you do select current underscore setting. There's a second one that appears later, show config by name. That's actually the function in the database that gets called when you execute this thing. So a lot of the lines that you'll see in pgproc.h, those will be the same thing. The external name will be exactly the same as the internal name. But in some cases, they're not, and you just need to be careful that you change the right one of those when you go in and create one of those from scratch. So what happens with all these things? These get processed by a heinous Perl script, like there's another kind. and they all get spit out into this other thing here, this postgres.bki file.
It used to be a heinous shell script, so I think it's a win.
Yeah, it's gotten better, and eventually it'll be a wonderful Python script, I guess. I don't know. Postgres.bki, what I would highly recommend that you do is go look at pgproc.h and go look at postgres.bki, and you can actually see how these things get converted. Also, the very top of pgproc.h, if you look at it, you'll actually see a description of what each of these cryptic fields are in this thing. They're actually all spelled out, and if you puzzle over them enough, you can do it. So really, the only good way to understand how this thing works is stare at pgproc.h for a bit, read the documentation that's at the top of the file to try to understand it, look at examples of things that are like the function that you want to build, and then you can also look at what comes out of this thing, which also is kind of informative to help you understand why it's in this bizarre cryptic format. The other thing that's kind of a useful bit to know is that these things vary in length, because if you had multiple parameters that were passed into this whole thing, you'd end up having a much longer line here, because there's a little chunk of, I think, three additional bits for each parameter. So something that had five parameters getting passed into it, this line would be much longer and you'd have a lot more stuff in it. Where those three nulls are at the very end, there'd be more of those kind of stanzas describing, okay, this is what this parameter is all about. So how does this actually work? There's some source code in the function manager directory that actually does something useful for this. So there's a utility function, there's a series of utility functions in the database called direct function call 1 through 9. What happens when you select something that's a UDF and basically execute it is it looks at how many parameters are there, and then it calls whichever is the appropriate one of these things for that number of arguments. And the README kind of explains this whole thing. It's basically you just put in, you just have to make sure that your function, when you create it, has the same number of datum things listed as you said you took as input parameters, or you get a really cryptic error if you don't. And if you have a function that's in the database already and you go, I'd like to call this thing as a subroutine, but it's not a regular C subroutine, it's actually one of these external UDFs, you can do that. You can actually use direct function call yourself and call that thing and kind of convert your things that you're working on into datums, pass them through the function call interface the same as if they'd come from the outside world, and then you'll get a datum back from that thing, and then you convert it back in the other direction. So there's actually a ton of functions in the database already that you can borrow for this sort of thing. There's actually so many of them, it's kind of overwhelming just trying to find one that is similar to yours, and it can take a while. You might use the /df command to go find them and look at that and go, okay, well, that's the list I have to work with, but you should recognize that that doesn't actually list the things that are called built-in functions. The only way to get that list easily is to go look at, again, the source code for something, which is this list that's in builtins.h. Also, if you're already poking around in pgproc.h, that'll actually show you all of the functions that are in there as well. But again, that file can be a little bit harder to read than builtins.h. So, you know, what I'm trying to do here is give you a flavor of these are the files you actually need to look out so that when you're trying to learn more about this, you at least know, okay, if it's only documented in the source code, that's one thing, but if it's only documented in the source code and you don't even know what the appropriate source code file is, that makes it that much tougher. So part of what I'm trying to do here is give you the roadmap of how you actually go learn more about this stuff. So here is the actual source code to that function that I showed you the header for before. This is show config by name. So this says that show config by name returns a datum, which is going to be pretty much everything returns, and it takes in this PG function arguments, which is a macro for some set of functions that go into there. So it uses a couple of these. This is basically just examples of the types of conversion hoops that you end up going through to write your own UDF pretty much inevitably. So the thing that's getting passed in is the name of the GUC that you want to do something with. So the first thing it does is take that in datum form, which could be any kind of, it could be a string that's compressed, it could be a string that's over in toast. You know, you don't really know what kind of string it is, but if you run text datum get C string, whatever format that datum is in that the rest of the database is working with it, you'll get back a regular plain old C string that you can then operate on and do something with. So this pulls the first parameter back. The next thing it does is it calls an internal subroutine that actually does the real work here. And this is a pretty common idiom within the database to produce a subroutine that actually gets the details that you need, kind of test that thing works, and then add something that exposes it as a UDF. Because if you do it that way, you've now got something that other functions in the database can call directly to get useful work done, and you've exposed it to the outside world. So anytime that you've got some sort of internals you're trying to expose, you really want to consider following that approach and expose the internals in one function that's a regular old C function, and then wrap that in another function that actually does all this datum encoding and decoding, like as the only thing it really worries about. So when it's done with that, it then converts the thing, uses more fun macros and stuff to take that C string and turn it back into a regular bit of text, and then return that thing as a text pointer that basically is used as a datum here. So this is about as simple as functions get. So here's the sample that I'll lead you through here in the rest of this. I run into this question sometimes. You set shared buffers in your system, which is how much data or how much memory is dedicated to the database for caching things. And some people say, well, I've got a giant server. I allocated 10 gigabytes to that. How much of it's being used? That's a question. In other cases, people that have small data sets are pretty sure that they all fit into RAM and the database is caching them directly, but they'd like to know how big that working set is. In both of those cases, you can get that data theoretically by going in and looking at the internals of the buffer cache. You can do this in the existing source code by installing this module called PG Buffer Cache, which exposes each of the individual buffers in the buffer cache, and then you can run counts over them and stuff like that. The numbers are never going to be 100% accurate because there's these ring buffers where it reuses memory. There's this list of free buffers. The trivia of that is not really the point of this talk. But the point is If you knew how many buffers had been used, kind of a high watermark for them, that'd be an interesting number to know. So I kind of set out to expose that and see where it went. So who has this data? Well, the background writer code is scanning that. I've played just a little bit with the background writer code at one point. The actual list of buffers and which buffers are used and are not used are sitting in this chunk of thing called the free list. And the way this works is whenever you allocate a buffer in the database, and this topic is basically the entirety of the talk that I'm doing tomorrow, so the quick preview is when you allocate a buffer in the database, it treats the block of memory that you've given it as a circular list, and it kind of works its way down there. And once it gets to the end, it just starts over again and starts making another pass and just keeps doing that over and over. There's actually, as of 8.3, there's actually a counter that says how many passes has it made over the cache. So it's actually possible to figure out, again, theoretically, we're going to see how this works out, that if you look at the number of passes it's made, if it's made more than one pass, then you've definitely used the entirety of the RAM. If it hasn't, then you have to look at what the next free chunk of memory is, and then that'll give you an idea what's already been used. So that's the implementation idea I had for that. So that turns into the following game plan. I'm going to find that hidden value for this chunk of data. I'm going to go find a similar UDF that returns something kind of like what I'm returning. I'm going to shamelessly steal that code, and then I'm going to write a UDF wrapper that then exposes that thing to the outside world. And this is a very similar game plan for other types of internals you might want to expose. So here's how I built that thing. So this is the low-level routine that gets built first. That actually does the real work of exposing something. This is living inside the free list code because this information isn't even really available, visible anywhere but the free list code. There's this private structure in there called the strategy control that keeps track of everything. So access to the strategy control bit is obtained by getting an exclusive lock on this buffer free list thing. So I grab a lock on the right thing. I look, have I made at least one complete pass? If I have, I've definitely used everything in the buffer cache. If I haven't, I go look at what the next victim buffer, which is the next thing that's due to be considered for allocation, is. And that's kind of how far down the thing has gotten in the allocation so far. So, you know, I either return the size of the entire cache or I return how far down it's gotten using the space up. In either case, I then release that lock that I had. And again, anytime you grab a lock, you don't want to hold it for very long. And then I return that thing as an unsigned integer, because that's what type one of these two things is, so that's sufficient to hold it. So this is the low-level part. All this does is expose some deep bit of internals data so that other things within the database can get to it outside of just the hidden free list code. So I've kind of abstracted that away. So the next step, I looked around for a bit and I decided I want to return something that's kind of a big number for how much RAM that you've got. It kind of seems similar to me to the routines that we're running in, that give you database and table sizes, which are in the dbsize.c code. There's things like PG relation size you may have used at one point that gives you how big something is. That seemed like something that returns a number of bytes, how big something is. I'm returning a number of bytes for how big something is in the buffer cache. So that's the code that I borrowed to kind of try to work out how this would go. So similar to the config example I showed you before, you know, I set up some things. I go figure out how many things I've used. I convert that into an actual number of bytes, because the low-level thing returns an answer in terms of how many buffers you have. I want to return to the user the number of bytes, so this block size bit lets me convert in between those two, and then I use one of these magic macros to return this 64-bit value back to the datum that is around this definition. And then that deals with the details of whether 64-bit integers fit in directly in an integer on this machine in this implementation, or whether it's a pointer to something, and then we don't have to worry about that part. So you work with the smaller native types, and then you just let these wrappers do the conversion in both directions as you need the data to go in the format the database expects them in. So next we need to make something in that lovely pgproc file that actually runs this thing. So this one isn't too different from the example that I showed you before. The main things that are different, obviously the function, the OID has changed. I needed to get a new one of those. The name of the function is different. The name of the function that gets called is different. And the main things, the main things that you need to make sure you change the right value that are not so obvious. Where this other one had zeros and ones, this one has a 0 and a 20. In this case, 20 is the internal OID code for I'm returning something that is of type int 64. So you always have to do these looks up and figure out, okay, if I've got this type, what is the actual OID of that type if I want to do something useful with it. So put that in there, doesn't take any input parameters, so don't have to worry about any of that stuff. The other thing that you'll end up needing to do, if you run this without the bits at the bottom, it may still work, but it's going to kick out a bunch of compiler warnings that I'll show you what they look like in a second, that says that you've used the function before defining it properly. So these last two bits here are also pretty standard. If you're going in and you're adding a new UDF to somewhere, you need to, whatever chunk of code that you're looking has probably got an associated header file somewhere else that includes all of the functions that are the C functions that are in it, some of which are UDFs, some of which aren't. So you need to add a reference to that. So I needed to make one of those for the low-level code that I produced, and then I had to make a second one and add it to the list of built-in functions, which is the end goal of this whole thing. So those two details are easy to forget, especially because they won't produce compiler errors. They'll only produce compiler warnings, but woe to the person who submits a little patch that introduces new compiler warnings in because they didn't follow the guidelines on this. This will not help your patch. This is the one case where increasing the size of your patch is actually helpful. So, debugging. Here's some samples of some problems I ran into when I wrote this code. This lovely cryptic bit, invalid memory alloc request type. What was that from? Well, the first time I wrote it, I gave it the wrong type for what the datum was. And so I was returning a datum that had one size of data, and it was expecting some other size, and when it tried to sort out the memory allocation for the whole thing, it just went completely insane. So that was the reason for that thing. The second one is the warning I was just talking about avoiding. When I just added buffers used in and didn't include it in the appropriate header file, it spat out this implicit declaration of function stuff. So add that in, and that goes away. So you probably want to go into the subdirectory that you're adding the new code to and run make just on that subdirectory so that you can go looking for these warnings. If you just build the whole compiler tree, you're probably going to miss it as it goes by. And then just to be able to do some debugging on this thing to figure out what's going on with it, I set the client min messages, kind of shows what messages the actual PSQL client are going to have show up in its output directly, so you don't have to go looking in the logs for them later. They'll just show up. So I added, it'd be obvious if I went back to the other slides, if you look at this later, that you know the number of buffers used in the low-level thing, I print that out as a log message, and then the ones that are actually used, print that out as another thing, and you just need to the e-log statement's a pretty easy way to add stuff like that in, and if you if you're kind of suspicious of the code, you can put those in there, and then you get to make the fun decision later of whether that information is valuable enough for general debugging purposes that you want to leave it in there in the patch, or once you've kind of proved that it works, that you strip that out before you actually give it to anyone and have them run with it. So it runs now. The function gets called. There's no compiler warnings. And so then I start looking at it going, OK, well, I exposed some stuff. Is this data useful for anything? How's it work? Doesn't work at all, actually. So I just showed you a function that doesn't do what it's supposed to. It's kind of the data that you get back from this low-level thing, it's always zero. I'm still not exactly sure why it's zero. But this is actually the reason why I left this slightly broken example to lead you through is because it's an interesting warning about Postgres development and how these things tend to go sometimes. You have to realize I was taking some data that I saw the background writer doing something with, and I mimicked what it was doing. But when you're running this UDF, you have to remember that your UDF is a client with its own little client process, its own little memory space, and that sort of thing. There are shared things in the database that you can get to, but just because you think you can get to something doesn't mean that you're actually getting the copy of it that's going to give you anything useful. Your client process is not the background writer, and so when I just took code that the background writer is executing, not being the background writer process, the user code doesn't have the same shared memory, it doesn't have access to the same sort of things. The process model in Postgres is pretty complicated, and you need to be aware that sometimes there are bits of data that you might want to expose with UDF that it's just not available at the point where a client process would look at it. As an example of how this gets worked around, there's a process that runs in the database called the statistics collector. What ends up happening, a lot of this data that people would like to just be exposed with UDFs, it's really impractical to expose them as UDFs because the process that knows the information is not talking directly to the clients that actually want to consume the data. So rather than just this easy exposure with a UDF that I showed you how to do, what you have to do for some of those cases is actually send the statistics collector messages to get that data kind of passed around inside. So the other thing that this is kind of an interesting warning for is this feature doesn't, no one has exposed this bit of data before. There are a lot of things in Postgres that you might see that you might look at them on the to-do list or something like that, and you might go, wow, that looks like a really useful feature, and that looks pretty straightforward to build. I'll go running and working on that. Well, the thing to realize is that if something is easy to build and obviously useful, someone probably built it already. So the only things that are left on the to-do list are stuff that is unexpectedly really, really hard. So you have to be careful that you don't invest a lot of time in writing code if you haven't done some basic due diligence that the information that you need is even available. Like in this example, if it turns out that a client process just can't get to the chunk of memory that I need to expose to get to this internals, this whole idea is dead in the water. So this is another idea why you want to start with smaller functions. You want to keep the complexity of stuff simple. And what's great about UDFs as a way to deal with this is it gives you a way to expose something inside the database. So having built this infrastructure, I've now got a function that I've exposed to the world that I can get to from user space that pokes around and lets me look at things in the internals of the database. I can add logging to it. You know, it's basically old school printf debugging, but you know, a lot of times that can be a useful way to learn what's going on. So having this UDF in place, even though this mission wasn't actually successful and built a working product, I've got something that now lets me look at, well, just where is that information visible from? And I can kind of build from there to do something useful with it. And I didn't spend too much time. Because there's so many of these items with hidden complexity to it, this is why a lot of times people will recommend, before you actually start writing on a patch, go onto the hackers list and actually ask you know, what's involved in implementing this patch. You might think it's something simple, and someone will go, ah, well, the reason that's not there is because of this crazy gotcha that you can't get to there from here. Just that's how it fits together. Everyone's trying better to actually update the to-do list itself to include links to the discussions that describe why previous efforts to this stuff failed. That we're doing a little bit better job of now that we have more people than just Bruce working on that problem on the wiki. But anyway, this reinforces what I was saying at the beginning about trying to keep things simple and bound your scope rather than just assuming you're going to go off and build something massive. So you probably want to see a working example rather than this code that doesn't work I gave you. Earlier this year, a very similar function was added to the database. It's called there's two of them called PG table size and PG indexes size. They're really handy functions that do something similar to what I was just showing you, which is they return something that's a 64-bit integer that is the size of stuff inside the database. This even includes samples for how you build documentation and all this other stuff. This is a patch that I had a little bit of design input on, and then I ended up reviewing the whole thing. I didn't actually write it myself, though. But, you know, there's really no substitute for finding, if you want examples, go find ones that are actually been committed. And one way you can do that is if you can actually track down the commit that added something similar to the thing that you're interested in, sometimes that commit becomes kind of a self-contained example of how to build this stuff. And so that long, complicated URL, which you'll be able to decipher once this stuff gets uploaded on the conference site, actually goes right to the source code for that commit, which is surprisingly readable. I mean, the bits that it actually uses to do the computations are kind of opaque, but it's a good working committed example that you can poke around at of something that exposes a bit of internal stuff that it used to be kind of difficult to get. It also highlights one of the other little bits of trivia here. All of this information about what functions are in the database and all this other stuff, that appears at the point when the database is actually created. And once that list is populated, just making a change to the source code does not update that function list automatically. If you're building external functions that you load in, you may not have to do that. You may not have to worry about that. If you're building internal functions that actually live in the database, what you may end up having to do is actually rebuild the whole database to get it to recognize this change so that you get kind of the new catalog structures that include that new function that you've added. The terminology everyone uses for this, there's this thing called the catalog version that says what version of all the function signatures and everything else that go along with a particular database are there. When you actually go to add add something for real to the database, that is going to involve what they call a cat version bump, which is basically going in and saying, okay, I changed the catalog at this point, and if you want to be compatible with this new version of the database, you're actually going to have to run the initdb command and create a whole new database because the one that you've got doesn't include all the functions that binary expects at that point. And that's there we go. So to kind of recircle back on the kind of recurring topics here, you want to keep stuff small. You want to read other people's code as much as you can to get examples from. You then want to shamelessly steal those examples whenever possible. And the great thing about Postgres is even though it's very complicated and it's difficult to see how the process model and executor, all this other stuff fits together, you can always read the source code if the documentation fails you. And if I weren't able to read the source code for this stuff and I just had the documentation and some examples, I would have really been hard-pressed to actually understand what I was playing with when trying to do this. So even though there are spots where I could be a little bit critical of the documentation that's available, the source code always lets you sort out what's really going on, and reading through it is often inspirational for getting ideas for how to build things. And there we are, right on schedule. So that's the end of my allocated time, so I guess I'll field questions at this point.
Yep. Just had a slight comment. There is a roundabout like get FN expression archetype.
Right.
It's useful. So you don't get it from the data. You have to know your function that took that data in, and then you say, what is the archetype of the ith argument?
Right, yeah, So if you actually have the function thing that you're doing, you can chain back and figure out what that random datum is supposed to be, but it's still not in the datum itself. It is possible to query the metadata for the function directly and then find that out if you need to know it for some reason inside the function.
It's really useful.
Yeah, that can be handy, but
you need to know what the
datum is. Yep, that's a good and a highlight on that a little bit.
That becomes really important if you're dealing with a polymorphic function.
Right, polymorphic stuff that take all kinds of types in, and you need to go say, okay, I want to use the same function for all of them, but go in and figure out what to do based on what the input type is. You can actually do that by using these little things. Oh, sorry, it's a popular image for your head explode. Yeah, so actually, it's good Joe mentioned something, because these talks I was talking about at the beginning, if you go back to those with this background I already gave you, you can actually make sense of those. So some of the... Yeah, exactly. You might get to 34 or 35. So, I mean, Joe's talk is actually really good, and the examples are great, but they don't kind of bridge this gap between newbie and actually knowing how all this low-level stuff fits together. I thought quite well enough, you know, that it doesn't answer the really basic questions like what's a datum and how's it used and that sort of thing. And I found it difficult to figure, and other developers I've talked to found it difficult to figure that out on their own. So that's why I covered some of those things. Well, if you've got something that's actually touching the internals in the database, that isn't really a possibility at that point. But the documentation that I was referring to that you can work with, those first two links there, actually, that's what they show you how to build, are functions that are built outside of the database source code, using the headers of the database source code, but not actually being built with the server itself. There's this mechanism called PGXS that lets you go do that, and then the result you can link into the running database server without actually even having the whole source code tree available. You just need some headers and other stuff like that. So that's actually the simpler thing to do, and the examples that are in the documentation lead you through that. The additional layer of, well, what if the data I need is not accessible and I got to expose it first, is kind of that more complicated problem that ends up leading into this two-phase implementation and the rest of these other details. The one that you're talking about is actually even easier to do, but often is not what people want to start with. They want to start by building something a little more complicated than that. But good examples of things like that, back when I was working doing financial analytics, I remember building a little UDF to compute like real low level mathematical operation, just because it was just way faster than you could do it in SQL. So that's an example of something you might build in a user space UDF. It doesn't need access to anything inside the server internals or anything. It's just some C code that you want to be able to call directly from the database. There, in addition to this exposing internal stuff I was talking about here, there's all kinds of ways to go in and write UDFs just for building things in C that for some reason are difficult to build in SQL directly.
Yeah. Well, in general, loadable functions have access to all the global symbols inside the backend, but fortunately Postgres will not expose everything that's global.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what you can't get at.
Right, so that's why in this case I had to go poke around in the source code to just even expose the bit of data that I needed to get to at the beginning, because it was private to one particular function and not part of the globals that were available for everybody to run stuff against. Okay, I think looks like we've settled down and are done here. So I hope you found this useful, and I'll have the slides up on the PGCon website here as soon as I can upload them when we're done. Yeah, probably. I got to go do a round of proofreading on this thing, perhaps at some point. But yeah, there you go. Thank you. I'll fix that. All right. So thanks for your time, and enjoy the rest of the conference. It's like I was saying, if you know which source code modules to look at, the source code's easy to read. It's just finding them in the mass of source code if you're not good at
and
that.
And deciphering pgproc. And that's great. And I'm sure all of us have gone through that. By the way, you're not on IM anymore. I don't see you. A bunch of times I've been going to ask you questions and you haven't been on.
Yeah, I've just been ridiculously busy recently, and IM is one of those kind of distractions that's kind of been lost. My whole schedule clears up next month, and then I'll be much more available and friendly after that.
Okay, so there's nothing I'm missing then?
No, I just haven't been on there very much. I've kind of had way too many days where it's all I can do to make it through the day without any kind of interruptions.
And how's the book coming?
Oh, the book's doing good. I'm about 210 pages done. It's scheduled to be 300, so a little over two-thirds done at this point. Still chugging away. Still expecting to finish in the middle of June.
That's exciting.
So, go from there.
No.
Hey, thanks.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. So if you just sign this, you fill this out and sign it, and then just name, and then...
Do you still have your address at your own domain?
And now we're
back? Here, you have an email address listed on the web as your own domain.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get my message about
the BWPOG? Did I know?
Yeah.
Okay.
No,
I got that.
Okay. All right. Just making sure that was the right way to go.
I remember coming back to it one day and going, did I ever find it all? The last month has been very difficult.
Yeah, no worries.
So, yeah, I got that, and the answer is just that with all the conferences and everything else, it just hasn't been anything. So
right.
I think you're on the right place, and just nothing's been happening. But So Robert, do you think we might start back up the BWPUG in June?
Okay, cool.
So there you go. That's
cool.
We'll get it done.
All right. And by the way, I have you to thank for being here. You told me at PG East about it, and that it was mid-May. Well, my 20th anniversary was yesterday.
Oh, yeah?
And I went back to my boss and said, we were planning to go to Toronto anyways for our anniversary. How about you just send me to Oslo instead? And they went, okay. So we're here on their dime.
That's always sweet if you can arrange it.
That's right.
Thank you.
clients are. So.